Hi, it's Robin Young. Thank you for listening to Here and Now. There are thousands of podcasts out there. You chose this one. It's your thing. Listening choices are part of who you are. And the choice to support your favorite NPR program is yours, too. Visit donate.npr.org/now to donate to your station. Then share why that's the kind of person you are. Tweet or create a public Facebook post with the hashtag WhyPublicRadio. From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The Alabama Secretary of State says he will certify the results of last night's earthquake special election sometime after Christmas. Republican Roy Moore, who was defeated last night by Democrat Doug Jones in deeply red Alabama, is refusing to concede. Today, Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer called on Republicans to delay a vote next week on their tax cut plan until Jones is seated in the Senate. Jones's victory means going forward, Republicans and President Trump may only be able to afford to lose one of their own votes to pass anything in the Senate.
Unless they try to pass things before Christmas. Our political strategists join us now. And this week we have Paris Denard, the Republican strategist. Hi, Paris.
Hello, hello, hello.
And Angela Riot, the Democratic strategist. Hi, Angela.
Hi, it's a great day.
Well, so say you, but we want to hear from Paris as well. Angela, you start. What happened last night?
I think that the moral majority won. And what we learned is that the moral majority is not language that can be exclusively owned and should not be exclusively owned by the Republican Party. I am elated and thrilled with Alabama. Grateful because they surprised me. And I just want to say, like I said on Twitter, thank you to black people. 98% of black women showed up for Doug Jones. 93% of black men showed up for Doug Jones. Did they win the election by themselves? Absolutely not. But this is a group that has been repeatedly taken advantage of, not just by the Democrats, but by the Republicans and everyone in between, but by particularly in this instance, Democrats. And I think what we've seen is that when you make a little bit of an investment and you ask people who are loyal to show up, they do. And so I hope that Democrats use that as a model going forward. If it works in Alabama, it'll work in anywhere, in any state.
Well, something we were going to ask you, do you think Democrats have been, you know, taking advantage of African-Americans? They have more maybe claim to some attention now. But Paris, you know, there was a woke vote, they were calling it. These were evangelical African-Americans saying, you know what, we're going to take back the language of white evangelicals. We have just as much right to Jesus. Your sense on what happened last night?
Well, I think Jesus is colorblind, and so I don't think that there
Come
is
on
a,
now.
A black evangelical, white evangelical. I think there are a lot of
But that was their point. That was their point. I'm sorry.
And the point I'm trying to get to is that there are a lot of black evangelicals who are conservative and who actually vote surprisingly on conservative values that might not be registered as Republicans, but they are registered Democrats who are black evangelicals. You look at Bishop Charles E. Blake, who's the head of the largest Pentecostal African-American denomination, the Church of God in Christ, worldwide.
Who would not call himself conservative, Paris?
I said conservative values and principles, who came out strongly against the former President Obama as it relates to the issue of abortion and on the issue of gay marriage. And so there are black Democrats who are evangelical, who are conservative in their values. Look at what happened in with Thad Cochran in Mississippi a few years ago. Thad Cochran won that election not because of the white Republican vote. He won because there were a lot of black people who came out to support Thad Cochran, and that helped him win that election. And they weren't blacks that were Republicans, these were blacks that were Democrats, but they knew that Thad Cochran could get it done. So to Angela's point, it is very important for both sides of the aisle to take serious the voting power of the black vote as well as the millennial vote who came out to vote last night.
Angela, one of the big losers appears to be Steve Bannon, also President Trump, we should say. What do you think about their clout after the endorsements that they made of Roy Moore in Alabama?
Well, you know, Jeremy, I have to be honest with you. This used to frustrate me when President Obama was in office. I think the reality of it is, you know, you can be a celebrity influencer. You can be the president of the free world. You can be someone who is known to be a brilliant strategist that got, right, the president elected. And you still don't have as much sway as the voter who goes into that voting booth. And I think that we learn that in every single election. We know that all politics is local. We know a million and one of these lessons, right? You can and use your influence to the best of your ability. But ultimately, it comes down to the voters deciding to do what's right or what's wrong. And thankfully, Alabama did the right thing last night.
What's the right thing now? Paris, we're just hearing the president this morning. He's speaking with Republican leaders who seem to have reconciled, at least in principle, their two different tax plans. And he says, I want a vote by Christmas. Of course, as we just heard Jeremy say, Doug Jones won't be seated until after Christmas. And here's Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer this morning on Jones and how he might vote on the Republican tax plan if he's seated in time.
I've spoken with Senator-elect Jones. I have not asked him how he'd vote on the tax bill. He will make a decision based on what he believes is good for the people of Alabama. And throughout this campaign, it's been an Alabama campaign all the way.
So, Paris, should Republicans wait until this candidate who fair and square won an election is seated?
No, because the president has been talking about passing this and having it on his desk by Christmas. Christmas is on. Jesus was born on what we say. We
you
celebrate
don't know
on
that.
December
25th. So
we say December 25th is the day that he was born, and that's the day that we celebrate Christmas, and that's what we should have this bill to the president before that time. And Senator Schumer knows full well that he believes that Doug Jones is going to be a vote for the Democrats, because if he didn't believe that, he wouldn't be so strong in saying that we should delay the vote.
But what about what happened yep. when there was a similar situation with Scott Brown when he won a special election? And then at that moment, the Democrats said, we're going to wait to vote on Obamacare until after Scott Brown is seated.
Listen,
boom, Paris.
Boom. But, you know, Republicans are going to be smarter. We're not going to take a chance on this.
Oh, come on.
We need this vote, and it is important to do. The president wasn't moving the goalposts. Well, we'll see what happens with Alabama. He has always said, and we can go back, they actually wanted this done before Thanksgiving. And we moved it to Christmas because it couldn't get done by Thanksgiving. But this is important to get done in 2017, and he wants it done before Christmas. He's been saying that for a long time. This issue should have been taken care of a long time ago, but they have been dragging their feet. I hope they can get something done this week.
You're using a lot of words and talking really fast, but you know
I got
substantially
4 minutes.
I substantially disagree. That doesn't mean you should take all four. This is not the Senate. Do not filibuster the people. But no, I think the important thing that we must remember is the Alabama people have spoken, and we know where Doug Jones stands on this, because we know where he stands on even the children's health insurance program, which is to ensure that that's well and fully funded. And so I think that they should have the opportunity to have their voices heard. It wasn't passed by Thanksgiving. It doesn't have to be rushed through Christmas. And even though it was not, we don't know for sure if it was Jesus' birthday on Christmas, it is my grandmother's 100th. So
well, she deserves a tax
for
cut.
That.
Do the
no,
tax cut
she,
for her
what
grandmother.
She, what she deserves, what she deserves is an opportunity to be heard and ensure that the American people are treated fairly. Those are the values of my grandmother, and it sounds like the people of Alabama.
Let me ask you one other thing, because we are enmeshed in this new battle front between President Trump and New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who, of course, had been critical of President Trump after women came forward again to, you know, allege sexual harassment charges against him. She spoke about that. And then he tweeted out, Paris, that she would do anything for a campaign donation. I know the president's spokesperson said, Sarah Huckabee Sanders came forward and said, your mind has to be in the gutter to think that that was a sexual insinuation. It has always been a sexual insinuation. Someone would do anything for something. What are your thoughts on that?
I think your mind has to be in the gutter. I mean, I think
then
if I'm
mine
hungry,
must be.
I, you know, if,
mine
if I can't, I would go in there. I said, "Oh my God, I would do anything for a hamburger right now." That is not a sexual innuendo. But let's just stop.
What about when he said it about Megyn Kelly that she had blood coming out of her wherever? What did you think of that? Was that an innuendo?
The president has used that. He used that. The candidate Trump used that phrase before talking about other people. And so I don't think that was anything sexual right there, because that is a term. When you say blood coming out of someone's eyes. So look, we can make that a sexual term, but here's the point that I want to make. If you want to say that it's sexual, women of the Senate on the Democrat side, I missed you coming out and having press conferences denouncing what Cedric Richmond said, the congressman, about Kellyanne Conway being on her knees, saying she's used to that position in the Oval Office.
But you know the difference? You know the difference? He apologized for it. It was terrible.
Because he knew it to be...
Because it was repulsive, and he apologized for it. In Paris, I am dying for the day when the Republican Party will find its I'm not even going to say what I really want to say, but find its soul. How about that? Since we're all on innuendos today, and start holding this man accountable. We're talking about 16 accusers in. We're talking about Megyn Kelly. We're talking about now Kirsten Gillibrand, all because he's threatened by these folks. Look at what he says when he's threatened by people.
Well, Paris, it's take it up. Paris, go ahead.
I just disagree. I think that these are people are reading into it what they want to read into it. The phrase "I will do anything." I mean that you can take it to the gutter if you want to.
But isn't it one thing for you to say "I will do anything" and someone else to winkingly say "she will do anything"?
When did he wink? Be real. When did he wink?
Parenthetically.
Right. Come on, Paris.
Parentheses are winks. Hey,
you can read into it if you want to, and I think that's the danger that we do.
You have to read very far.
But Paris, real
quick
question.
This is a Dr. Seuss book.
Quick question though, Paris. We only have less than a minute. Don't you think that elevated her somewhat? I mean, she's getting support. She's getting donations. Do you think it backfires?
If she knows what she's doing and she had her
she
own issues
a couple
she had her own issues a couple of weeks ago when it came out what she said about the Clintons, and so she goes back and forth and she has her own issues to deal with where as it relates to women and women issues. Okay. But again, I go back to the point, if President Trump felt he said something wrong, he would apologize for it, but there was no innuendo. Cedric Richmond knew he said something that was wrong and it was derogatory, and the Democrat women of the Congress did not stand up for women. They were silent because it was the Republican that was attacked.
Paris Denard, Republican strategist, and Angela Rye, Democratic strategist. We didn't even get to say farewell to Omarosa, who's leaving the White House.
Bye,
farewell.
Girl.
Thanks to both
Bye.
Of you.
Bye.
Thank you. It's Here and Now.
The Federal Communications Commission is expected to vote to roll back net neutrality rules tomorrow. The vote would undo regulations put in place during the Obama administration in 2015. FCC Chair Ajit Pai and internet service providers like Verizon and Comcast have been pushing for the change. Companies like Google and Netflix have been pushing back. Ben Johnson covers tech for Here and Now, and he joins us in the studio. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jeremy.
So first of all, explain to us what the FCC is expected to decide. What does removing net neutrality rules mean in practice?
So this vote would basically move the FCC to stop classifying internet service providers, or ISPs, as so-called common carriers. I'm talking here about both the kinds of companies that bring internet to your house and the kinds of companies that deliver internet via cell service to your phone. And if the government sees them as common carriers, then it means they have to abide by a bunch of rules designed to protect consumers. In this case, we're talking about the rules that say if you're Comcast, for instance, you can't make it easier to access stuff from a Comcast company, NBC TV online, than, say, Netflix. Without net neutrality rules in place, the concern is that Comcast or another internet service provider could throttle or even block certain data from getting into your house. An example of that would be your internet service provider not really liking Netflix. And so when you try to watch Netflix at home, it doesn't load or it's really slow. Service providers could also create what are called fast lanes, where companies like Netflix or Amazon might pay to get their stuff to you faster than YouTube, for instance.
Now, these rules have only been around for 2 years. Is there evidence that there were big problems with blocking and throttling when the rules before they went into place?
Yeah. So, Jeremy, this might be a rare case of government trying to get out ahead of a problem. Might be blowing your mind there. But in a way, this set of potential abuses that net neutrality is trying to protect against is really just starting to loom large. We're doing more online than we've ever done. Networks are fast enough to deliver us all kinds of content. So companies that we might traditionally think of as television companies are more involved in giving us internet. We're also seeing a new host of technologies, a lot of them on your phone, that could be used to create and deliver an experience of the web and the internet that might be a lot more like your old cable television bill. The AT&Ts and Verizons and Comcast of the world would argue that if they've not abused the system before, why would they do it now? But we have also already seen cases and accusations of throttling, for instance. So it's up for debate.
And this has also turned into a big fight between the tech giants like Facebook and the internet service providers like Comcast.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. Service providers say they're doing a ton of infrastructure building, like laying the cable, and that's expensive, and that tech companies like Netflix, Google, Amazon basically benefit from all of that without paying much for the infrastructure itself. But there is more to the story. This could impact not only big names in tech and business, but also much smaller companies and startups, because the rules or lack thereof get applied across the board.
So is there fear that reversing these rules would stifle innovation?
Yeah, the innovation argument is really interesting because it sort of comes from both sides. People who are against net neutrality say that it prevents some of the big telecom companies and service providers from experimenting, innovating new ways to deliver internet across access to users. I've talked to a really small internet service provider out in Wyoming. It's called Lariat. The company's head, who is anti-net neutrality, is named Brett Glass. He says a lot of the current rules prevent him from figuring out new ways to get the internet to remote areas in Wyoming. And that's an interesting perspective, right? When there are problems like a virus impacting people's routers, for instance, out there, he can't just block the bad stuff and protect his small set of customers because that runs afoul of net neutrality rules. Now, the other side of this is that if you're a couple of college kids trying to build the next big tech company, the next Netflix or something, you'll never be able to pay Comcast's fees for getting your service in front of its customers. Basically, the idea is getting rid of net neutrality might have a huge impact on the ability of startups to build new products and the ability of consumers to discover those products.
So what does this mean for those of us who are using the internet? I have to say I've been using the internet long enough now that when it really slows down, I think, oh, it's just going slow right now. It could be that I'm being throttled by my internet service provider or my cell phone company or whatever. But yeah. What is this going to mean for us?
This is a really good question, and it's hard to know because it's sort of early days of how these companies are figuring this stuff out. If the FCC votes this week to scrap the rules, we will have to see how the marketplace reacts. A lot of people have been making this comparison to cable TV, how you might have to basically pay for a bundle of internet channels to get the services you want. But it's really an open question of how it will turn out and how it'll impact the user. But the internet still feels right now this kind of Wild West place where you can find anything, people can build anything and deliver it to you the same way, no matter which company name is on your internet bill or right. Your wireless bill. Not having these rules might really change that.
That's Ben Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Ben, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, in Austin, Texas, the new Homeland Security Secretary, Kirstjen Nielsen, urged other states yesterday to emulate the Texas ban on sanctuary cities. Oregon has been a sanctuary state for the past 30 years, with a law designed to limit how much state and local police can help federal immigration agents. But for years, two local jails in the state have regularly housed detainees for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And a judge is set to rule on whether one of the jails can continue working with ICE. Oregon Public Broadcasting's Conrad Wilson reports.
A high chain link fence topped with razor wire surrounds the Northern Oregon Regional Corrections Facility. The jail, known as NorCor, is in the Dalles, about 80 miles east of Portland. Inside, inmates are divided into a series of large open rooms connected by a long tan hallway.
And so this is one of the immigration dorms.
Okay.
So as you can see, it's no different.
Brian Brandenburg is NorCor's administrator.
There's 22 beds back there. It's an open dorm format.
Inside the immigration unit, two ICE detainees watch television, both in their prison jumpsuits. At its current staffing level, NorCor can hold a little more than 200 adult inmates. That includes ICE detainees. Four neighboring counties combined their resources to pay for the jail. Sitting at his desk, Brandenburg explains that the detainees typically come from a 1,600-bed private prison ICE contracts in Tacoma, Washington.
They have a capacity at that Tacoma facility, and so we provide that relief for them if they should go over that number, and they do their best to keep our numbers up a little bit.
Across the country, ICE uses roughly 200 local jails and prisons to house some 38,000 people detained for possible deportation on any given day. NorCor is one of two jails in Oregon that have agreements with ICE to house detainees. But some say that violates the state's sanctuary law that's designed to protect immigrants. That 1987 Oregon law prohibits local police from enforcing federal immigration law or helping federal agents go after people whose only violation is being in the country illegally. Jail officials say they're not violating the letter of Oregon's law. Yet dozens of public records and interviews show they could be skirting the spirit of state law designed to make immigrants feel more at ease.
It's the issue of using Oregon resources for a policy and a practice that I think is very dangerous.
Stephen Manning is an immigration attorney. He's representing a group of county taxpayers that fund NorCor. They've asked the judge to rule that the jail is in violation of Oregon's sanctuary law, and they want the judge to force NorCor to end its ICE contract.
Should we be using Oregon resources to participate in this depopulation, this mass expulsion of people of color? I think that's a choice for Oregon to make, and I think it's a choice that we should be making in a very conscious, active way.
The ruling could provide clarity about what's allowed under one of the country's oldest sanctuary laws. In a courtroom last month, NorCor's attorney Wilford Carey argued to a judge that the jail is doing nothing wrong.
There's been no evidence whatsoever of any illegal or unlawful use of public resources. We are following religiously what the statute says.
Carey argued Oregon's sanctuary law prevents detecting or apprehending persons, but says nothing of housing an individual who's already been captured. The second Oregon jail housing detainees is located in Josephine County, near the Oregon-California border. Though it's not being sued, county leaders have had a similar stance about the jail's relationship with ICE. Lily Morgan is the county's vice chair.
We're not doing anything but providing a bed for them in the night and meals, so it's not a matter of us enforcing anything. It's renting a bed, like a motel room.
The Josephine County Jail, but even more so NorCor, rely on the ICE contracts to balance their budgets. NorCor gets about $4 million to fund jail operations from the four counties that use it most. But Brian Brandenburg, the jail administrator, says the total cost of keeping NorCor open is about $6 million a year.
And so that means that I have to make up $2 million in revenue. And so that's where the ICE contract comes in.
Without its ICE contract, NorCor would need to reduce staff and services or find new money to support operations. And for now, that seems unlikely. Last year, the four NorCor counties asked voters for a permanent levy to help pay for jail operations. But it failed. Had it passed, it would have raised about $1.3 million a year, roughly the same amount NorCor predicts the jail will receive from ICE this year. For those suing the jail, the case is about more than money. If a judge finds NorCor has violated Oregon's sanctuary law, it will mean even less revenue for the jail. But it would be a significant victory for those who oppose the federal government's efforts to deport people who are in the country unlawfully. A ruling in the case is expected before Christmas. For Here and Now, I'm Conrad Wilson.
And the deadline to sign up for health care through the Affordable Care Act is this Friday, December 15th. Okay, you may not know that because the Trump administration has cut pretty much all the advertising and cut funding for the navigators. These are people trained to help consumers choose their plan. So let's find out what you should know as the talk on Capitol Hill is about rolling back Obamacare and the Trump administration is making cuts to the plan. Erin Mershon is with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Hi, Erin.
Hi there, Robin. Thanks for having me.
Well, I mean, there's so many questions. First of all, maybe fewer choices of insurance companies for people buying insurance on the federal exchange. What might people face when they go to sign up?
So I think the biggest difference this year, and really one that you can't underscore enough, is that the open enrollment period is so much shorter. It's literally half as long as it had been in years past. So where before you might have been able to wait until your Christmas holiday or into January to sign up for coverage, this year you have until December 15th, that's Friday, and that's it. So if you're looking to sign up for Obamacare, you need to do it by Friday.
Right. Well, and there might be some extensions possible if, for instance, something's not available for you. So explain what they might find when they get there.
Sure. There are some states that have set longer deadlines, and there are other sort of special enrollment periods you might qualify if you have a qualifying life event or something like that down the road. But for the most part, everyone needs to either renew their coverage or sign up by Friday, especially in the 39 states that use healthcare.gov.
And what might they find? There's things like cost-sharing subsidies, there's premium subsidies. So what is still there?
Yeah. So what we're seeing in the marketplaces this year is very different from what we've seen in the past. And partly that's because it's been a very uncertain year when it comes to health insurance in general. You've had Republicans talking since January about trying to repeal the law. And I've certainly spoken to consumers who think it already has been repealed.
Right.
So that confusion is not only out there for consumers, but it has been out there for insurance companies, too. And we've seen a number of them decide to limit the options they would sell in some states or even pull out of the exchanges altogether. So consumers shopping might indeed face fewer options. One of the things that President Trump did right before open enrollment was end the so-called cost-sharing reductions, which are separate from the premium subsidies, but which sort of were designed to help especially low-income people better afford their copays and their deductibles. But because of the way that that impacted different prices for different plans, we're actually seeing options out there where folks are getting more subsidies, so their options are actually cheaper than they had been in the past, or in some places they're able to get an even better plan for cheaper than they were paying for the plan they had this year. So dynamics are all over the place, and it's sort of heightening the confusion, but also increases, I think, the need to go on the website, shop around, compare your options, and see what's out there for you.
Well, that may be why you shouldn't do the auto enrollment. Some exchange insurers automatically renew your coverage, but you can stop that default because you might get a cheaper plan.
That's right. It's possible your plan prices will go up, but it's also very possible that your plan prices will have gone down or could go down if you shop around. So there's options out there where you might be able to get a better plan for only slightly more or even slightly less. And in some places, we've even seen $0 premium plans available.
Right. Get the insurance, no matter what you think about it politically. Erin Mershon, Washington correspondent at STAT. Erin, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much, Robin.
It's time now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Anthony Valadez is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. And Anthony, we are a few weeks away, but let me be the first to wish you a happy new year.
Thanks, man. You too. It's so great to be here.
Well, and you brought us your top songs of 2017. Let's get right to them, starting with the soul singer Nick Hakim. This is Needy Bees. Great song to start us off. Tell us more about Nick Hakim.
Nick Hakim is from D.C. originally and now based in Brooklyn, New York. This is his debut record. It's called Green Twins. You know, he fuses the sounds of Unknown Mortal Orchestra. He's indie rock, but he's also soul. If D'Angelo had a kid with all the members of Unknown Mortal Orchestra, it would definitely be Nick Hakim. I hope that didn't sound too graphic.
And why did you pick this song as one of your favorites of the year?
It's funny because I could have went with Bet She Looks Like You, which is one of the songs we're playing nonstop on KCRW, as we should. It's such a great song. But this one, I feel like, demonstrates the range that Nick has. There's a sexiness oozing in his voice, and then the drums and the vocals on his voice. I feel like there's a lot of technicalities that are celebrated on this record, Green Twins, especially on this song, Needy Bees.
All right, well, next we have Eye to Eye. This is by the New Zealander Jordan Rakai.
Yes, they shine bright like a million, let them bleed twice for a minute. Pleasure to have met you. You must start tonight. To have felt this, oh, sublime, like a grain of sand traveling through time. Pleasure to have met you. You must start tonight. We'll be right back.
I love what that guitar is doing in the background there.
Yeah, it sonically, it has different parts. There's a part where the beginning of the song, it sounds very optimistic and hopeful. And then all of a sudden, there's this dark transition that's very menacing. And what I love that he does on this album, and specifically this song, is that he's dealing with his inner demons. If you listen to the words, he's talking about social anxiety. And I had the chance to interview him, and he talks deeply about how social anxiety has always impacted him. And he wanted that to be very reflective on this song and the album as a whole. So I love what he does, and I feel like that's represented in the textures and the guitars and the rhythms.
And he's just 25 years old, by the way, Jordan Rakai. What more should we know about him?
Originally from New Zealand, now living in the UK. And what I love, too, is that he mixes club culture with the Kiwi soul sound. So there are a lot of cool remixes, dance remixes, and he's part of what I call the SoundCloud generation, the artist that made remixes or put out their music on SoundCloud. And it's nice to see him get picked up by a great label and, you know, he's graduated, so good for him.
Okay, next we have another one of your favorites from 2017. This is the electronic house musician Yeji with her song, Drink I'm Sippin' On. Now she's singing in a mix of English and Korean.
That's correct. She has an interesting story. She was born in New York, and her father just got frustrated. He was a struggling musician, I believe, played in a heavy metal band, and went back to Korea, went back to Seoul, and eventually Yeji came back to study graphic design. She's an artist, DJ. She produces her music. Another cool thing about her is that she makes house music, and she also makes what I call trap raps. So you hear her rapping, you hear her singing, and she's very melodic, and she's adorable. If you get a chance, you need to YouTube her. Yeah, she's great.
Yeah, the music video for this song actually came out in October, and it's already been watched 3.7 million times. What do you think it is about this song that stands out?
There's definitely a juxtaposition from what you hear and what you see. There's an innocence to her, but there's also an attitude in her music, and I think that's what's gravitating people to her music and sounds.
Okay, up next in Anthony Valadez's list of best songs of 2017 is Four Ethers by Serpent With Feet.
Babe, it is cool with me that you want to die, and I'm not gonna stop you if you try. But the hole in my belly has started growing. Your name is about as easy to remember as the Four Ethers. And who the hell knows the Four Ethers? Oh.
Now, Serpent With Feet is the stage name for Josiah Wise, who's a classically trained singer from Baltimore. To tell us more about this.
That's correct. I mean, he's incredible. That voice reminds me of Nina Simone. There's especially that track. I mean, just listening to it, I got the chills. It should be noted that this project was in collaboration with Hakes and Cloth, who may be known for his work with Bjork. And one of the things I love about Serpents With Feet is that he describes his sound as pagan gospel. And according to Pitchfork, you know, this project explores the queer experience. And I love that. I love that Serpents attacks the content of his music with attitude and with pizzazz and with sassiness, but also with epicness. I mean, you hear the strings in that song. He's very incredible. And what he does with his voice is just, it's mesmerizing.
It's an incredible voice. And we have time for one more song. This is Love Galore by SZA featuring Travis Scott.
Do it for fun. Don't take it personal. Personally, I'm surprised you call me after the things I said. Skirt, skirt, on it, skirt down, you acting like. summer fling. I said farewell, you took it well. Promise I won't cry over spilled milk. Give me a paper towel, give me another value. Give me another hour or two, hour with you.
Now, SZA is up for several Grammys. The awards are next month. She's up for New Artist. Tell us more about her.
Yeah, five Grammys. She's the first lady of Top Dog Entertainment. That's a record label that is infamous because of Kendrick Lamar's association. She's very self-conscious. And what I love, you know, was that she didn't want this album to come out. She felt like she would be embarrassed. And so just to hear that it's nominated for five Grammys is a great thing. I also think she represents artists that really don't get a lot of love on the radio. You know, she also represents this generation of women that are breaking down barriers. And I think that's so important. And to see her being rewarded with all these Grammys and love from her audience and fans, which is a great thing.
So, Anthony, I know that we haven't gotten to 2018 yet, but I have a sense that you have already heard some of the music that we're going to hear next year. Anything good so far?
Lots of stuff. It's a secret. I signed an NDA. but I do want to say, Jeremy, that this has been one of the toughest assignments ever. Only five songs of 2017. This has been such an incredible year for music as a whole.
That's Anthony Valadez, a DJ at KCRW. Anthony, thanks as always. And again, Happy New Year.
Thanks, man. You too.
And you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. Just go to Spotify, search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson may have just put himself at odds with his boss again. Yesterday at the Atlantic Council think tank, Tillerson said the U.S. is ready to sit down with North Korea.
And we're ready to have the first meeting without precondition. Let's just meet, and we can talk about the weather if you want. We can talk about whether it's going to be a square table or a round table if that's what you're excited about. But can we at least sit down and see each other face to face?
Well, afterwards, the White House issued a statement saying President Trump's position on North Korea has not changed. And in the past, that position has been no talks without the precondition that North Korea give up its nuclear weapons ambitions. Jane Harman is president of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, a former congresswoman from California. Congresswoman Harman, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
So what are you hearing here? Is this good cop, bad cop? Is this a schism in the administration, which, of course, has long been talked about between the president and his secretary of state? What is American policy?
Well, I hope it's tilting. The arc of American policy is tilting in Rex Tillerson's direction. We've learned in the last several weeks that talks of Rexit are premature. But on North Korea, North Korea is a nuclear power. I don't think denuclearization, even if one can pronounce it correctly, is in our future or its future. The goal is, it seems to me, is that a freeze for a freeze is where this needs to come out. That means freezing the development, the use of nuclear weapons, but also freezing some of the things we, the community of nations, I hope including Russia and China, will do to, in North Korea's eyes, provoke it or challenge it.
Well, and of course, Rex Tillerson also said there would be a period of quiet while there were talks, yep. And that seems to sound like the freeze. But he also went on to say that the U.S. President, Donald Trump, agreed with him that there should be talks without these preconditions. And then we're also hearing about all the back-channel conversations going on, and we know there are many, but right. U.N. diplomat Jeffrey Feltman, who was in Pyongyang last week, he said he told the North Korean hosts that we really believe they need to signal they're willing now to go in a different direction. What would that look like if not denuclearization?
I don't think denuclearization is at all possible. I think containment is possible. Look, we have a relationship with Pakistan and India, neither of which asked our permission to test nukes. They both went nuclear without permission. And I think that this is achievable with North Korea. And I think that just saying they're crazy, we're not going to talk to them ever, you know, hasn't worked before.
But what do you think is happening? What do you think is happening?
I think on the ground we've had ongoing conversations with them, back channel conversations, which we don't talk about. Tillerson is more confident for whatever set of reasons, and said something that I think was very helpful. yesterday. And I think it is urgent with North Korea because let me make one other point. What does this regime want? It's a 70-year-old regime, the Kim regime. They want regime survival. They want us not to attack them. That's their most important priority, and I think they're willing to give up some stuff to make sure that happens.
To talk a little bit about Rex Tillerson, this notion that he was on his way out. You say maybe the thinking is tilting towards his. But, you know, the State Department has positions that haven't been filled. He had a town hall yesterday saying, you know, he will partially lift a hiring freeze. Your sense of the diplomacy and is it at full speed? I mean,
no. No, I wouldn't pretend that. There have been massive exits from the State Department. But let me say something about Rex Tillerson. I think he is experienced, certainly in running big organizations. I think the mistake he's made, and I told him this to his face, is that he hasn't explained himself on an ongoing basis either to his workforce or the public or the press corps. And I'm not defending all of his actions. Surely I'm not. But I am saying that the narrative has been missing. And had the narrative been there and had people been able to get to know him better, I think he would be building more support than he has built.
It's so interesting because other secretaries of state have become, you know, well-known in their own right. Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, you're right. Madeleine Albright, Condoleezza Rice, we heard from them. But in this administration, do you think somebody can take that limelight?
Well, Rex Tillerson would tell you he's not a politician. I don't think he needs to be a politician to explain what he's doing in the job. But at any rate, can someone take the limelight? Well, there are rumors that if he should leave, and, I think, again, predictions of his demise are premature, and he's saying he likes the job now. But if he should leave, the rumor, of course, is that CIA Director Mike Pompeo might move there. He is a former elected official, so he has different experience. And, again, the narrative has it that he, in addition to doing his president's daily brief and seeing the president every day for that, also engages on policy issues.
Jane Harman, president of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholar, of course, the former congresswoman from California. Congresswoman Harman, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And Here and Now is a production of WBUR and NPR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.